Because once you think that the value is measured by the high price, then you're, frankly, I think you're in trouble. I think that so many wine prices have gone into the stratosphere. And I ask myself, well, are they giving multiple times more pleasure?
From Napa Valley Wine Academy, this is The Stories Behind Wine, a podcast dedicated to the stories, people, places, and history that influence the world of wine. I'm Christian Ogenfuss, and in this episode, we bring you an interview with Hugh Johnson, with a focus on Hugh's most recent published book, The Life and Wines of Hugh Johnson, published through the Academy Duvan Library. Hugh has been a dynamic force for wine for over 60 years. His books and publications speak for themselves, with the seminal World Atlas of Wine and annual pocket wine books being required reading for any wine student. Hugh not only wrote about wine throughout his career, he has also been in the room. He knows many of the most influential people in the world of wine and was a key figure in the relaunch of Tokai Wines. In this interview, conducted by Catherine Bouguet, Hugh reminisces on his experience with the Queen in the wake of her death. Hugh never takes a step back, and this interview is no exception. He laments the absurd cost of iconic wines while offering his thoughts on alternatives. His insight into why Chateau Lafite is favored over Chateau Latour in China and much more are available in this interview. If you're interested in getting your hands on his book, The Life and Wines of Hugh Johnson, click the link available in the show notes. If you're interested in seeing the video recording of this interview, it is available as part of Napa Valley Wine Academy's annual membership. More information about the membership available at napavalleywineacademy.com/membership. Enjoy the interview.
I'm Catherine Bouguet, Head of Education at the Napa Valley Wine Academy, and I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to have Hugh Johnson on today. Hugh has greatly influenced our understanding of and love for wine for decades. His latest book, The Life and Wines of Hugh Johnson, is a whirlwind. It's part memoir with a corkscrew, as he says, part tasting compendium, including style comparisons of villages and producers from Champagne to Bourgogne to Bordeaux, part travelogue, as I'll share with you today a bit. This book can be purchased at the NapaValleyWineAcademy.com. Every library has to have it. In lieu of introducing Hugh via a brief bio, because his bio is a book unto itself, I'd like to share two gifts that Hugh Johnson gives to the wine world: his eloquent prose and his thought-provoking writing. I'll do so by quoting Hugh in a passage that I first read as a new student, two decades ago. And when I read this, I couldn't believe that someone put these words together. It still moves me today. So I quote, "How can a rare bottle of wine fetch the price of a great work of art? Can it, however perfect, smell more beautiful than a rose? No must surely be the honest answer. But what if deep in the flushing velvet of its petals, the rose contained the power to banish care?" Still moves me. With those words, we must turn to the author, Hugh Johnson. Hugh, welcome.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
We are so thrilled to have you. I know it's evening for you. I hope you've had a lovely day.
Well, we've had a very sad weekend, in a sense. The Queen having died, we're coming to terms with that, because that is huge for everybody in this country.
Yes. We were so sad. We are so sad to hear of the passing. And I know that you've met the Queen. She named you a British officer of the Empire. Maybe it's a nice way to start off tell us about meeting her.
Well, I've been lucky enough to meet her more than one occasion. And it she was a marvelous person in being both as formal as a queen has to be and friendly. I mean, somebody well said, she gave you friendliness rather than friendship, which is not surprising, but she was, in the few times I've been in her company, it's been fun.
I heard she has quite a sense of humor. Well, we pay our respects to the Queen. Maybe we'll help take your mind off of it. Would you like to dive into a discussion, Hugh?
Yes, absolutely.
So I'd love to talk a little bit more about this book. I was so excited by so many aspects of it. So The Life and Mind of Hugh Johnson brings history to life. You know, such are the rich experiences that you've encountered or created during your life in wine. At one point in the book, you know, we may be traveling with you as you travel through different wine regions, say different regions of Germany, getting a taste for the different styles of the Moselle and Rheingau Riesling. But then we find ourselves immersed in a historic moment in time as you share hearing about the momentous 1971 German wine law changes as they were happening. So we feel like we were there as well. Would you share with us, you were writing the Wine Atlas at the time, would you share with us that experience?
Yes, I was up in arms. I thought that the Germans were going in completely the wrong direction. And I'll tell you why. I was writing the World Atlas of Wine. I needed to do research in great detail because the geography matters a great deal, and mine were the most detailed maps that anyone had ever wanted to publish, I think. So I was asking about, I was in touch with the ministry in Mainz, where the government was based, and I said, may I have the latest rules and regulations and maps as soon as they're ready? And they said, yes, 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 of course, we'll send them to you. And they did, in relays, as it were. And when I looked at them, I said, wait a moment, this can't be true. What do you mean? You have cancelled most of the most famous names in German vineyards, or not cancelled them, but used them in a way which simply wasn't true. If you had a very famous name, from Johannesburg or Bernkastel, which were well known worldwide, they applied to a particular spot of ground, just as, let's say, in Burgundy, Chambertin is Chambertin, and the village is called Gevry Chambertin. It's not called Chambertin, it's called by the name of the village, Gevry. Well, the Germans were just taking the name Chambertin, or the equivalent, doctor, or something like that, and giving it to a wide area of the country. They invented things called Einzel, called Großlagen and Bereich, which hadn't existed before, which nobody understood. And so the whole basis of identifying a German wine precisely was blown up. And I was baffled, and then I was cross, and I argued with them. And I still do argue with them, because from being a quality, this is my argument, I was called an elitist because I wanted a specific wine to be that specific. They said, no, you are, that's elitism. And I said, well, quality is elitism, isn't it? And but this argument went on and on. And I lost, of course.
I so wish you did not, because of course it's so confusing, you know, today still. I mean, I know that the VDP is working towards, solving that problem, but I'd love to keep talking because there's so many historical stories in the book. We also get a historical perspective on luxury wine prices, as when you discuss the fact that champagne has become progressively cheaper in relation to other luxury wines over the decades. You write about a 1940s restaurant wine list that includes an air raid lunch and a blackout dinner. I mean, that menu itself is fascinating. You know, would you recount the story of that sort of menu and touch on the pricing of champagne versus other luxury wines?
Yes, this was a restaurant called Prunier's. It was a French fish restaurant in the heart of the West End of London. in St. James's Street, where at the time we had an apartment upstairs there. So I got to know them very well, and I found this historic menu, which happened to come from during the Blitz when Hitler was bombing London. And the French were so cool. I thought, I mean, Madame Prunier was as French as you could be. And it was what you would call, the French would call sort of English cool, was very French. It said, in the wine list, it said, owing to the recent bombardment, it is recommended that the red wine should be decanted. As though it would make any difference for wine that's been blown up by a bomb, whether it's decanted or not. And indeed, there was a blackout dinner, but this was because in the period of rationing during the war, there was a limit on what a restaurant could charge for lunch or dinner. And the record, I mean, I can't remember exactly what the limit was, but this was a luxury restaurant. They got around that by offering lobster, caviar, and things like that at, shall we say, prices a little above the norm. The wine list was fascinating because whereas in any modern restaurant, there is the list of champagnes is short compared with the list of Bordeaux Chateau. Naturally, I mean, that's the way it is. Not at Prunier's. No. The champagne list went on for about a page, and the Bordeaux list was rather brief. The prices, on the other hand, you could pay, and I can't exactly quote, but I think for a famous vintage of Bollinger, you could pay what in English money then we described as 37 and six, which is nearly £2. Whereas the most expensive Bordeaux on the list was Chateau Aubryon, 19, something like 21. And that was just over £1. So, okay, the best champagne cost twice as much as the best Bordeaux. Well, that's rather different from today.
Yeah, I just cannot believe that at the bottom of the menu they said owing to recent bombardment, it's preferable for the red wines to be decanted. it's just unbelievable, incredible. You know, I think if our audience out there, right, if anyone ever wanted inspiration to start a wine business, this book is it. I mean, we hear stories in this book of key industry players or wineries before they became well known. As with the early days of Bollinger, right? The late president of Bollinger, Christian Bizot, as you share, called you lucky for having had a 1945 Bollinger champagne, saying, "I remember when I was a boy and they were bottling the 45. They had to borrow a tractor with a belt drive to work the bottling machine. It was bottled whenever the tractor wasn't plowing." I mean, this. There's also the story of Tony, you know, Lathwaite. Would you inspire our entrepreneurs out there and maybe speak about either Tony or, you know, just you've seen the development of careers over your time?
Lathwaite is quite a story. Because, I mean, Tony Lathwaite and his wife Barbara, who is very, very much involved in the business, still 50 years after they founded it. Tony was just out of university, and he went to his hometown, which was Windsor, which is very much in the news just today. He was brought up in Windsor. He knew a lot of people there. And he'd been working for... he'd had a sort of vacation job in one of the minor cooperative wineries of the Saint-Emilion area. And he liked the wine, and he thought, well, people in London are not able to get wine quite like this. I think I could do something in the business. So he rented a little van. He filled it up with this cooperative wine. He drove over to London, and he rented an old railway arch in Windsor under the railway line on Saturday mornings. And he held a little sort of Saturday morning come and taste my wine affair, which was, people loved it. He called it Bordeaux Direct because he had brought it directly from Bordeaux. it was highly popular, and it was so popular that the Saint-Emilion cooperative got quite excited, and they bought him a van to keep going on this. It grew and grew, and so Bordeaux Direct is now the biggest mail order wine merchant, I believe, in the world. And people say that Tony and Barbara are the only people in the wine business who have made a real fortune. The standard remark about this is that if you want to make a small fortune in the wine business, you better start with a big one.
Right. I mean, it's incredible, right? Because he has built a business empire, owns a chateau, you know, and yet we get these stories through you of, you know, his pop-up, his, you know, it's just incredible. So I think for anybody out there who's working on their own business, go, go, go. Great. I'd love to talk, you know, you've had an opportunity that I've heard other people say they think that you might be the only one. You've had the opportunity to taste a wine that was made 24 years before Shakespeare was born. Can you tell us about that?
Well, strictly speaking, it isn't possible, of course, because wines that old have just sort of completely fallen apart. They're not just oxidized, they've rotted. They're just no organic food stuff, which wine is, can live for hundreds of years. Simply it's impossible, but it is because I tasted it. I won't say that the wine was highly and verifiably authentic. That is to say that it wasn't bottled until it was over 200 years old, simply because they didn't have bottles. So it lived in a barrel for at least two centuries. So it must have been topped up, presumably with the best and sweetest wine they had. It was inevitably a very, very sweet wine to start with. And in the end, if they didn't have a good enough wine to top up the barrel, what happened, as I was told, was that they used to drop pebbles into the bunghole to keep the barrel full, raise the level. Anyway, they treasured this. The barrel is still in the cellar where it lay. It's not a very big barrel, but it's very famous. So the wine was bottled as soon as bottles were invented with corks to keep it, which was in presumably late 17th or early 18th century. It was then considered to be the most precious bottle of wine in Germany, probably. It was bought by the King of Bavaria, who had a famous cellar. It stayed in his cellar until, mysteriously, in the middle of the last century, the cellar was sold. And I happen to know the person who bought this lot in the auction. And so, as a very young journalist, I was invited to the moment when it was opened. It was nobody had any hopes for it at all. It was preceded by two 19th century German wines, which had fallen apart, frankly. They weren't worth drinking. So we all thought, well, what hope for 16th century wine? And yet, when it was opened, we were each given a little bit. It was brown. And you smelt it and you thought, goodness me, this is wine. It's okay. It was oxidized, madeirized, as inevitably, of course, it had gone brown. But when you sipped it, it was alive. That was the thing. If something is dead, you know it's dead, whether it's food or wine. But this was actually still living on the sugar that had been created in the grapes by photosynthesis in that very hot, famously hot summer, more than 400 years before. Now, there is no other foodstuff or anything comestible or nothing you can put in your body which has lived for 400 years. That was a miracle. It taught me really a great deal about wine and the kind of thing that wine is and can be.
Now, that itself is thought-provoking. Very much so. And I love how you say in the book that more than the flavors, you respected its dogged grasp on life. Oh, that wine. I love that. I would love for, you know, our participants today to hear about, you know, your wine style comparisons in the book, because these are pots of gold for wine students. I mean, you're comparing either, you know, village styles or producer styles of key regions of the world. So, you know, for a student, especially of wine, you know, it's really either a starting point for them to learn about styles or a checkpoint, you know, for people who are, you know, studying and about to take, say, a wine exam with a tasting component, or actually for any enthusiast who just wants to, you know, hear about these differences in styles. I'd love for you to share some key differences, perhaps of a Bordeaux wine from different villages, such as a Pauillac versus Saint-Julien, or different producer styles, you know, whatever you would like to share with us today, because you do this for Champagne, Bourgogne, you know, Bordeaux, and many other wine regions.
Well, you've highlighted the great difficulty of any wine writer's life. You can't actually describe taste. You know, you can, color is measurable, but after that, it's not so much a description. I think the kind of attempts at describing wine, which involve great long lists of various fruit and flowers and heaven knows that the wine is supposed to resemble, they don't get you very far. In fact, I think they get me nowhere. I mean, it's very good. You can say, yes, there's a sort of lemon touch and the citric presence in the wine is evident, but that doesn't give you any idea of what the wine tastes like. I've always believed from the start that if it's possible to say what the wine does to you, the effect it has on you, the ideas that it creates in your mind as you sip it, I always think that verbs will work harder than adjectives. And if you could find a way of making the wine active and saying what it's doing, that is, it's jolly difficult to do, but it can sometimes work.
That sounds like great, great advice for the wine writers out there, right? For our journalists out there. I love that. Yeah, while the book is part tasting companion, it's also a travelogue, you know, which has us pulling out post-its and underlying must-see stops, you know, along wine routes. The book certainly does evoke the desire to travel. You take us on your journeys, and you cover terrain and roadways. I love when you describe that there's two different wine routes from Paris to Provence, and some key things you'll encounter along the way. And in fact, if you look at my book, I actually have it all post-it with visits I must do when I finally do get to Provence.
Show me your copy again and I'll sign it.
I love it. Do you have fond memories of a particular, you know, either a particular visit or a particular village that you've traveled, you know, because you've traveled to so many places?
Well, yes. I mean, the ones where I've been personally involved are probably the ones where I've got the clearest memories and I know most about them as well. And the obvious one that brings to mind is Tokaj in Hungary, because it has a great history. It was for two centuries considered it was the most expensive wine in the world in the late 17th, the 18th, even in the early 19th centuries. And then it died thanks to communism. The Soviet system was able to kill anything of any value, and it did. But we spotted my great friend Peter Vinding-Diers, who is Danish, hence his name, and one of the best winemakers in Europe, in my opinion. He has a historical bent just the same way as I do. And we were talking about Tokaj, and we agreed that something must be done. It was the one world-famous great wine region that got stuck behind the Iron Curtain and was virtually killed off. So we thought, well, let's go and see. And we did. And this was just after the anti-communist revolution, if you want to call it that, was 1989. And so we went in right at the beginning of 1990 together, and we went to the principal village of the Tokai region, the trading village, which was called Mad. You can imagine the jokes among our friends. We scouted around and we found that though 99% of the wine went through the sort of hideous machine of a big cooperative, where any individuality of most of the qualities was just sort of ironed out of it. There were one or two growers who had managed to hang on to small parts of their vineyards that had not been confiscated by the state, and were still able to make a barrel or two of their private wines. And when we tasted one of those, we said, oh, it's still here. It's still possible. The vines are here, the land is here, even the people are here. And it can be revived. I mean, because it's still alive, just. Well, I like the story of the ancient German wine. You know, if there's still life, you can do something, at least appreciate it. So we very laboriously started a sort of growers' cooperative there. And it wasn't easy at all because they didn't really get the point. They'd been working for so long with the sort of thoroughly bloody-minded Soviet system that they didn't get the fact that you could step out of it and do your own thing. And we asked the cooperating growers to bring us their grapes. And we looked in the wagons that the grapes were coming in. And they tried to cheat by adding to the white weight by throwing stones and mud. And we just said, what the hell do you think you're doing? This is going to be sold as your wine and you want it to taste mud? You're mad. So it wasn't easy to start with. But within about 3 years, we had managed to make the first, we were lucky. There was a very, very good and huge vintage masses of the nobly rotten grapes that you need for Tokai Hasu. And we were able to make a substantial quality. And that, funny enough, I had one of my last remaining bottles of the 1993, not long ago, with some friends. We were blown away. It was something marvelous. And one of the best tasting notes I've ever read in my life, which sticks in my mind as though I could rise to this level, was somebody who wrote about tasting an ancient Tokai, who wrote, it was so different from any other wine I ever tasted. It was like seeing a new primary colour. Well, think about that for a moment.
That gave me goosebumps. Well, now I understand why you called in the book The Royal Tokai Company a difficult child. Sounds like it was not easy at all. In fact, we'll have to raise a glass to you next year. We're taking students to Tokai. So let's talk about your, the travels that you discuss. What I love is that, you know, this book is a, you know, has a whole new 2 decades worth of changes, right, from an earlier version of the book, right? Everything has been changed throughout to update it for the last 2 decades. As well as additional, a new section. But what I love is that with these updates, you even tell us, like I wrote down, you know, for, hey, my next trip to Bordeaux, you tell us about Poyac's, a newer fashionable hotel there, right? The Jean-Michel Caz Enterprise, and even where to go to lunch. So you have me, throughout the book, you have me salivating. I'm always hungry and thirsty when I finish reading a chapter, which I just love.
I think I've just written the same book again and again and again.
You know? Not at all. Not at all. There's so much different in the book. And I do love those touches on, I really feel I have post-its on, hey, if, when I go to Champagne, when I go to Bordeaux, when I go to, it really does give you an insight, because you don't just say, oh, here's a lovely You know, you talk about the path that you take and things that you'll see. And I love you. You talk about a story about Bordeaux and how you wish, you know, that you were, you know, on a boat so that you were seeing the view as those who must have seen it, you know, hundreds of years before must have seen, you know, the region. It's just, you know, it's that whirlwind of travelogue and historic, you know, inputs. That's just, I just find it fascinating. You know, I'd love to go back
you're talking about the World Atlas of Wine, I think, at the moment, aren't you? Because I must just emphasize that the recent editions of the World Atlas, I did the whole thing completely on my own for the first edition in 1971. But since I did four editions on my own before I was joined by my great friend, Jancis Robinson, who was really, she is the leading author of the last two editions, at least, and just working on the next one to come, which will be the ninth edition. So basically, it's a book that we have revised regularly once every 6 years for the last half century or so.
I mean, I've read a lot online about, you know, you were the first really to create a book of this kind of maps, you know, of the major wine regions. So we owe that all, you know, to you. I love how you tell the story about writing that book, and you talk about, you know, you love to make lists anyway. So for the audience today, or whoever watches the tape version, if you love something geeky like making lists, it could become an incredible book. Would you tell us about your love of lists and about writing the Wine Atlas?
Well, yes, I have been called an encyclopedist, and that is because I do like making lists. And it's a way of approaching a subject. You know, you begin to study something and you wanted to put it in some kind of an order. And the alphabet is awfully useful, you know. I've done the same with trees. I've written two books about big books about trees. And it's not quite, it's obviously not the same, but organizing the subject involves the alphabet. And curiously enough, this is a bit of a departure, but in China, the top Bordeaux is Lafite. I mean, unquestionably, there are about 25 different wineries churning out what they're going to call Lafite in China, maybe 200, I don't know. And so I once said to a Chinese friend, now, it's a very funny thing, this, because it's all the Chinese sort of bogus first growth Bordeaux tend to be Lafite. Why don't you do Latour, Margaux? Oh, they said, because everyone knows what Lafite means. Fit means you're fit, you know, you're a fit person. So it means it's good for you. And I said, well, okay, but there are other first growths, you know. They said, but this is the first. It's first on the list. And I said, well, yes, because alphabetically, F comes before T, L becomes before M. So they say it must be the best because it's the first. And I say, well, it's just alphabetical. And they look blank because in Chinese they don't have an alphabet.
So fascinating. What a great insight. That's what I love. You know, you, as you speak, you write, and it's so thought provoking. You leave there thinking, you know, I go on walks sometimes after I've finished reading something of yours, and I'm thinking of it the whole time that I'm walking, because I really need to take it in. You know what I love is that you don't lose the magic. I mean, you could talk in detail, you know, about things. And I love, Eric Asimov said it best, you know, in the foreword to your book, he wrote, while Hugh knows the engineering, the details, he's like a good astrophysicist who can describe the universe without losing the wonder that comes from staring at a starry night. I just love that. I just wanted to share that. You know, I'd love, speaking of thought,
I loved it too.
I'd love, you know, because your writing is so thought-provoking, I would love to talk about, you know, you've tasted, you know, of course, some of the most famous, you know, wines of the world, and we revel in those with you. Yet your inquisitive palate also thoroughly enjoys Mouly, Lystrac. You know, you mentioned Chateau Chasplin, Mokayu, right? Making raw bones, saliva-inducing clarets, which give you a clear sense of where you are, as well as an excellent appetite, which I love. And in that vein, you tell a story of a perceived dinner, a tale of two wines. And I'll set the scene as you do in the book, because I'd love to hear your comments on this. But you set the scene of a dinner where you describe a chicken roasting in the oven, which has perfumed the room with its aromas and those of the rosemary sprigs that you've tucked inside. And you juxtapose those two wines to the scene, a Tuscan red, which costs about the price of the chicken itself, and another wine that the guest has brought, a very heavy bottle that probably costs five times what the chicken is, as well as a bottle of olive oil, which we all know the authentic olive oil does not come cheap. Would you share with us your thoughts on wine for recreation versus wine for food?
Well, just before I do, you mentioned the heavy bottle, because this is an obsession of mine. I mean, we had a rather good Spanish wine recently, which where the empty bottle weighed as much as a normal full bottle of wine. So I put it on a weighing scales, and it worked out at about 2.5 pounds for the empty bottle. And I thought, this is an outrage, an absolute outrage. We live in an age where we're using far too much energy in all sorts of departments, but making or transporting or doing anything with an overweight item is, I think, an insult to the universe, frankly. I've got off the subject now, haven't I? I've been riding a hobby horse instead of answering your question.
That's okay. I was just, you know, you just brought such a great, I don't want to say argument, right? It's a thought-provoking, you know, prose that you offer us, which is because you talk about the, you know, in fact, I'd love to quote it, because you say you talk about the Chianti, right? You salivate, you eat a piece of the thigh and you pick up the glass. You know, there's this beautiful symmetry. The Chianti was garnet. And then you pick up the heavier bottle, and you say, this is bloody ruby. I'm going to quote you. And caramba, the nose, a rush of sweet berries and a strong suggestion of coffee. You sip, you forget the chicken. This is Ferrari-powered Gucci shod. What is it doing here? What on earth should we be eating with this? Perhaps at that price, the answer is nothing. You should just sip and wonder. This is that thought-provoking, that this is what you bring, you know, to your book, to the audience.
The first thing to wonder about is the price, because you know, these luxury wines take you into a different world of pricing and thinking about value. Because once you think that the value is measured by the high price, then you're in trouble. I think that so many wine prices have gone into the stratosphere. And I ask myself, well, are they giving multiple times more pleasure? Or why are you paying that money? I mean, rarity is obviously main element in high prices, whether you're talking about art or anything else. You know, if there's only one of something, then it's the highest bidder, isn't it? Wine is not really like that. The posh wines, and call them that, have raised their prestige in many cases by raising their prices. And so cynics say, okay, you can't sell it for $10, try $20. And there's a lot of truth in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, but there's so much, just like you say, the Moulis, the Lystracs out there that just mouth watering and make you want to reach for your dinner, you know, take a bite, take a sip. It's a beautiful, you know, circular, never ending, right?
Those are the ones I love. And, and they're in many cases disappearing out of sight because everyone's chasing off the same things. And, you know, everyone is convinced that Cabernet Sauvignon can make the greatest red wines in the world. Well, is great wine what you're looking for in the first place, or you just want a really good drink to go with your dinner? And what about all the rest? I mean, one of the most encouraging things about what's happening in the wine world now is that we are talking about great varieties that never got a mention before.
Yeah, which I find fascinating. I'd love, because you know so much about wine and you share and you teach, but there's a great sense of humor, you know, that also that you sort of wrap, you know, into your career as well. I'd love to talk about the jokes that were mixed into your pocket guide. You know, as I was looking at them, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, there were hidden, you know, sort of wines in there for the audience to, you know, for the reader, you know, to find little gems. And I think you had I wrote them down here, a Coteau d'Afru, right? Afru means frightful. And you add, should perhaps use grapes as a base. And then there was the Domaine Dégoulas, right? Dégoulas means disgusting or monster stomach. And you have the Pinocchio with a variable nose. I mean, you must have had so much fun with this. Tell us how these entries came to be.
Well, you know, the alphabet is all very well, but as I was writing that book, which the first time was 40-something years ago, I thought, you know, this is supposed to be entertainment as well as reference. People want to see that wine is not entirely serious. You know, you can have a joke about it. So I've made up a few jokes, quite honestly.
I love it.
Some things that if you have no sense of humor, you won't even realize that they are spoof entries, but they're not spoof entries.
Of course, now everybody's going to be going back through their pocket guides trying to find them. I'm going to be one of them.
Unfortunately, Catherine, what's happened over the course of time is that the book gets inexorably longer and longer and longer. It's got twice as many pages as in its current edition as it had originally in 1977, mm-hmm. I think. So things get squeezed out. That's the problem. That's why the jokes have got squeezed out. I mean, the editor said to me, is that essential? I said, well, yeah, it's just me. And they said, but it isn't real. And so bit by bit, they get left out. And once a thing is in, I mean, once a new chateau or domain or producer is in, it's very hard to leave them out. There are a lot of people clamoring to get in, but nobody's clamoring to get out.
Right. Well, this will be a fun game, I guess, then, for people who have the older editions. So let's see. I'd love to take a few of the audience questions. I know that someone says here they know that you were on the board of Chateau Latour. They want to know what that experience was like.
Well, it was very flattering to be invited, I must say. For a period, Chateau Latour, between 1962 and 1981, Latour was under British ownership. And then it eventually was bought by perhaps the richest man in France and is no longer. So I think they wanted, the British directors were all businessmen, and I am not a businessman. I think they wanted a bit an alternative view. They wanted somebody who loved wine, who knew Bordeaux reasonably well, and who could just add a bit of spice maybe to the board meetings, which I did for a while. I learned so much. I mean, with that, the two wine producing companies I've been involved in have been Chateau Latour, the greatest wine in Bordeaux, and perhaps the greatest red wine in the world, mm-hmm. and the Royal Tokaj, where I sort of got the thing going. I can't tell you how much I learned doing that. You've got to absolutely follow every detail of the process. I learned almost as much doing that as I did growing wine myself when I planted a vineyard in an impossible part of France, where everybody says, you cannot make wine. I said, well, you know, I'm not going to make it for sale. I'm just going to make it because I like the idea of making wine. It wasn't great, but it was fine on the family table.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. You know, I think on that note, I'd love to hear more about that vineyard. Tell our audience about your vineyard.
Well, we bought a farm in the very poorest part of what is known by La France Profonde, deep France, which is right in the center of France. It's fairly high, and it's the soil is terrible, the climate is terrible, but I'm all about trees. I wanted to plant trees. And this is within the purlieus of the most famous oak forest in France, the Forêt de Troncay. And anyone who knows about barrels will know that a Troncay barrel is the ultimate. So here was this farm right on the edge of the forest with these magnificent oaks. I mean, the tallest, straightest, most beautiful oaks on earth. And I thought, well, you know, I love trees. I'm going to plant some oaks myself. Then I discovered that the French government, in its wisdom, gives subsidies to people who plant trees. I thought, well, does France really need more oaks? But anyway, they paid for a lot of my trees. And
Bravo.
we planted a lot. And then I thought, well, I've got the land. I'm going to have a go planting a vineyard, because I also discovered that every French farmer has the right to plant a certain number, a small amount of vineyard. I think it's something like half an acre. Maybe an acre, without getting permission or anything, because he has the right to make wine for his own family. So I thought, well, I am a farmer. I can go ahead. I can just do it. And there was a nice-looking south slope on the most appalling soil. And I planted, what was it, about 4,000 vines, and then had the job of making the wine. And boy, did I learn when I was making my own wine.
I bet. So you have to tell us what the grape varieties were.
Oh, well, I planted, it was about one-third Chardonnay. It was all white. About one-third Chardonnay and two-thirds a little-known Bordeaux variety called Sauvignon Gris. Mm-hmm. It's related to Sauvignon Blanc, but I prefer it, actually. It has a bit more wine in it somehow. It's not quite so aromatic, and the aromas are not the same, but it ripens fairly early. It's a very hardy plant, and I just like the idea of planting something different. So my wine was two-thirds Sauvignon Gris, one-third Chardonnay, if all came out well. And, the business of picking it and persuading it to ferment and the whole thing. I wrote about it in my memoirs. And I'm jolly glad I did it. I'm not proud of it. We called it Mouton Blanc, white sheep. Now, that's a funny thing to call it. The reason was that the only thing on our farm when we bought it practically was a lot of wild sheep, feral sheep, all of which were sort of dirty brown and black. So a white sheep was a rare exception and very special. So I called it white sheep. And I also was having a little dig at Philippine de Rothschild, Mouton Rothschild.
Right.
Calling it the white Mouton.
Oh, goodness. I think that's a great story. I love that story. I think, let's see, I'd love to take a few. We promised our guests we'd cover some questions. We have one here from Clyde, who says, what are the greatest wine books that you have read? Maybe you want to mention one or two that, you know, wine books that inspired you or that were thought-provoking to you.
Well, wine literature is very interesting. And the recently founded Academy du Vin Library, for which Stevens, the late great Stevens Parier, was largely responsible, has set out to republish a lot of wine literature which has gone out of style or been forgotten or underrated. And this is a great idea. And several of their books have been really seminal. What is the greatest wine book? I really don't know. I mean, I go back to the sort of basic wine book that all the French producers use, which was written by Chaptal, who was Napoleon's Minister of Agriculture and Minister of Industry and Minister of most things. And he sort of used all the previous wine books and he summed them up in this great work, which has actually never been translated into English, as far as I can find out.
But it is a shame.
It is, it should be done. I should do it, I know. But Chaptal, Traité sur la Vigne, is such an eye-opener because he starts, and this is in the 1820s, roughly, so 200 years ago. He starts by slating the French wine growers, saying, "You are such an idle lot. You're making rubbish wine. You ought to do better. This is how to do it," which is rather surprising in a classic book.
Incredible. Yeah, I know that you have, I think, some bubbly in your glass, but we have a question about a different, or actually, I don't know what's in your glass, but we do have a question about the about Sussex. And if you have any thoughts about either English sparkling or Sussex getting its PDO, a PDO.
I'm not sure why there's so much emphasis on Sussex, actually, because it is one of the southern counties of England where wine is a big success now. I mean, it is by no means unique. Kent is equally interesting. Hampshire, ditto. It's all along the southeast coast of England, or not necessarily the coast, but the southeast part of England, including the Thames Valley, inland from London, where excellent sparkling wines being made. Much more emphasis on sparkling than still wines, which have not really convinced people yet. I think they will. And we can credit global warming with it for sure. Our weather has been definitely better. There's a longer growing season for the grapes to ripen. But the speciality has been sparkling wine, because for sparkling wine, as in champagne, you don't need very ripe grapes. What you want is high acidity. That's the basis of the whole thing. And we're frightfully good at that. I mean, the best English sparkling wines, or bubbly, as I like to call them, are up to champagne quality easily. Mm-hmm. They don't yet have the long tradition. We don't have old vintages yet. But we do have fabulously stylish wines, which are all very fresh tasting. They have the secret of great sparkling wine, or most great wines, is acidity. Acidity is not a very attractive word, and people like to call it something else. They use this word minerality, which doesn't really mean much. But acidity balanced with the other elements that make fine wine is the liveliness in it, and it's the longevity in it. And we can do that in spades in England. And some of our wines are so lively. They remind people of beautiful fresh fruit. An apple, a perfect apple, that kind of thing. And we love them. I mean, I now buy as much English bubbly as I do champagne, or possibly even more, because I want to explore the makers who are finding their feet. There must be maybe up to 20 already making first-class bubbly. And they won't go around the world very quickly because, of course, there's a very limited quantity. You know, champagne is made in, talk about mass production, it's absolutely huge. They get grapes from a very, very large region. They persuade the vines to make an ungodly amount of juice. So we just can't and don't do that, and probably never will. But the quality element and the character are sensational. So I really do encourage anyone in the States who loves to explore the wine world to invest in a bit of a few bottles, that is.
I agree 100%. I'm sure you've had Stephen Spurrier's. His is so delicious. Yes, I was lucky enough.
Bright Valley, yes.
Yes.
That and the Académie du Vin Library were Stephen's great projects when he so sadly died. His widow continues. And it's a lovely place, and they're making lovely wine.
Yeah, and so thankful. And so thankful for the Académie du Vin Library, because if not, we wouldn't hear these great voices that have shaped, you know, our wine industry. I can't even imagine our lives without these books. I'd like to sort of wrap up our, you know, session here today with another quote from the book, where you say you're discussing Riesling and being impressed that it does well in cool Germany, as well as warm Napa and Barossa. And you say, what a plant, what an instrument the Riesling is to sing in such different keys with the same lyrical voice. Well, I read that and I thought, oh my goodness, this is also your magic. What an instrument, singing about so many different topics, yet with the same lyrical voice. I mean, your inquisitive mind is so infectious and inspiring. It just ignites. It ignites the wine mind.
You must give most of the credit to Riesling for that.
Well, I know that a good Riesling can, yes, open up many.
Bouncing around this, but I do want to just put a little emphasis on UC Davis. Because when we moved house 20 odd years ago, no, not as much as that, I didn't know what to do with all my archives. There was an attic full of archives and a lot of books and things. And I looked around for probably a university anywhere that would be interested in having them. And I approached UC Davis, and to my joy, they welcomed this collection, and now they have it, digitized the whole thing. And I met Mackenzie Smith, who was the head librarian, who was a great expert on digitization. And she became enthused, and then I introduced Jancis Robinson to her at lunch here one day. And Jancis said, well, I've got archives too. So they went into the collection, and then it really began to snowball. And Warren Winiarski, bless him, gets the point of this. He says, there's everything at Davis about winemaking, but not about wine appreciation. So why not have a wine writer's library? And then now it's a serious archive. Got all my stuff, got all Jancis's and a lot of other writers. My great friend Bob Thompson in St. Helena has contributed his marvelous things. So that is important for the whole subject of wine appreciation.
Mm-hmm. And that's something, how lucky are we, you know, that you're sharing, you know, these things with us. Besides sharing so much of yourself with us, I have to thank you so much. And I know, and audience, I'm so sorry we didn't get to all the questions today. I do have them here, and maybe I can, you know, convince Hugh to answer a few by email, and we'll share those answers with you. But I want you to go have a nice dinner, Hugh. And thank you so much for being, you know, with the Napa Valley Wine Academy today, you know, for, you know, having your books at the Académie du Vin Library so that they're, you know, shared once again with the world. It's so important for us to have, you know, these wonderful literature assets at our fingertips.
All an author wants to do is share his thoughts with the world, really. I just want to raise my glass to everybody who's been joining in this conversation and say cheers, good health, long life, and enjoy your bubbly.
Thank you for joining us this week on The Stories Behind Wine. If you would like to suggest an interview subject or show topic, please email us at sbh@napavalleywineacademy.com. Again, that email address is sbh@napavalleywineacademy.com. If you like what you've heard, we hope that you'll visit our website, napavalleywineacademy.com/podcast. and share us with your friends and colleagues. We'd also really appreciate a positive review on iTunes. It really helps out. Be sure to check out the archive section on our website for previous episodes and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at NapaValleyWineAcademy.com. Join us next time for another episode of The Stories Behind Wine. Until then, thank you for listening.